Hello and welcome to Unofficial Partner, the Sports Business Podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Sport Radar is one of the big beasts of the sports business. It provides software, data and content through subscription and revenue share arrangements to sports leagues, betting operators and media firms. It serves more than 1,600 customers across 120 countries, including DraftKings, Twitter and ESPN. It's official partner of the NBA, the NHL and NASCAR. And in 2001, it went public with an IPO on the New York Stock Exchange, which valued the company at that point at $8 billion. The company's valuation today is less than half that number, but it remains directional in terms of second-guessing sports relationship with some big themes such as betting, media convergence, and customer data. And our guest today is Mike Faulkner, VP of Strategy, who was formerly a panellist at our Sport Convergence event at London's Olympic Park last year. The first bit of the conversation is about ICE, or ICE, which is the international event held in London for the gaming and betting industry. Unofficial Partner is the leading podcast for the business of sport, a mix of entertaining and thought-provoking conversations with the who's who of the global industry. To join our community of tens of thousands of people, sign up to the weekly Unofficial Partner newsletter and follow us on Twitter and TikTok. Sean went to did our annual visit to ICE in London.
Did you?
It's quite a thing. And what I always forget is just how central sport is to it, because it's everywhere and it's embedded into it. And I mean, the stands, I mean, they're like villages. It's just extraordinary. But people talk about the sports business and whatever. You think, well, actually, that's so central to that bit of the conversation. Mm. And I don't know, I just came away with my sort of head spinning.
I think you're right. It has evolved a lot over the years. I'm not sure how many years you've been going to. And certainly it is a bit of a kind of stand-off, literally. He's got the biggest. But what is interesting is the different constituencies of sport who now attend, because it's got to that position now. If you're a rights holder, team, league, whatever it may be, that betting question is important and central. Increasingly, media owners likewise, it's a great way to replace lost ad dollars. So, and of course, all the betting companies and technologies are there as they normally are. So I think it'll be interesting to see if that continues when it goes to Barcelona next year. I don't know if you realise that, it was the last London ICE. So it goes to Barcelona. And I think it's been helped in London because there's a sort of bunch of people there who can just stroll down the road. Whether the same groups will make the trip out to Barcelona, where it'll be a bit more costly, a bit less of a kind of drop-in, that kind of stuff, we'll see. But certainly in London, it had got to that, to a status which it's never really achieved before in terms of those people, the breadth of people that are attending.
I hadn't realised that, actually. I didn't realise it was the... Because I haven't been there for long. It's just the last few years that we've been sort of popping our heads in. And literally, it's... Because it's free to get in, isn't it? We just pop in and we see a load of people and then come away. But whether I go to Barcelona on it, I don't know.
Yes, we'll see. I mean, it's obviously not a bad trip, but just a bit further and, a bit more costly. But we'll see.
So there's a few things I want to talk to you about. Because you're just in the middle of things. I always find it interesting talking to you because... And I think I find Sport Radar interesting just because of their positioning. And then... We should talk about what your job is. I'm interested in a day in a life almost. What is it that you do on a day-to-day basis? Because I know what the job title is and we'll talk about the various strands to this. But before we get into the specifics, how do you frame your job? I mean, strategy at Sport Radar, what does it mean?
Okay, good question. I mean, if you look at Sport Radar's provenance in becoming Easter, call ourselves the kind of sports source code of sport, and for many years have been fueling and enabling the global betting markets. And then as the business evolved and we built wider relationships, we started to think about the question of, okay, what other data and technology-driven products and services can we bring to market? So a lot of my focus is on a couple of verticals within the business. One is what we call fan engagement, and the other is marketing services, and they're kind of joined but separate now within the business, but the orientation and the purpose really is the same. So it's how can we help the broad range of customer groups that we have access to. So, of course, still sportsbooks, but increasingly rights owners, probably a couple of thousand of them around the world, media owners, tech businesses, Google, Meta, whomever it is. How can we help them through the provision of scale digital technology products? How can we help them engage more effectively and monetize more effectively their own fan bases or audiences, let's say, more simply? So we have a range of different layers to that that I think about, I suppose. As I say, marketing services is one of them. So we've built a technology platform for sport, if you like, an advertising technology platform for sport that we're constantly trying to develop and evolve and build out capability and channels it can serve and the size within it and so on. We've got a fan identity platform. So as the world goes first party, as we describe it, how can we help particularly rights owners, but not just rights owners, really start to capitalize on the fact that they are in a strong position in respect of their first party data. So that is a whole layer of capability that we're looking, that we've been investing in for 2.5 years, but we're looking again, how can we accelerate that? A third area is what we call storytelling. So that the content, if you like, that we provide to various customers that help them tell the story around their own sports. And we're investing very heavily in areas such as virtualization and visualization, for example, so that we can create digital twins and really start to build out the range of ways that the story of sport could be told. And of course, all of the great data capabilities we've had for a very long time, how do we modernize, evolve those so they really can tell insightful, innovative stories around people's enjoyment of sport. We then have what we call an interactive layer, which is, okay, how do fans participate within sport? So what are the things that they can do, get involved in? How do we build that kind of interactive, participative bridge between fans and sport? And that's a big developing area for us. Gamification, social functions, all of these sorts of things that fans now kind of expect or consumers now expect.
Would that have a sort of real life application? So is it something like, for example, I'm thinking of, so the Tiger Woods thing, the TGL, it's golf, but there's a link back to people playing golf and trying to then use that data to try and visualise and play against the pros, etc. Is it in that sort of era? Is that what you mean by interactive? Yeah,
certainly it would include it, exactly. So it's how can, and again, it always for us comes back to data and technology, how can we build or impose or exercise scale data and technology capability to enhance that experience. So Virtual Stadium, for example, is a product of ours. So it's, as the name suggests, it's without having any audiovisual rights, it's a great way of someone enjoying a game. And of course, not everyone can afford AV rights, wherever they may be, media owners, sports books, whatever it may be. So it's an increasingly sophisticated story, if you like, or platform is a better word, I think, in terms of how the game is unfolding. And then we build chat functions and social betting functions, perhaps, and polling and other forms of participation in and around what is this kind of virtual stadium. So that is a good practical example of the sorts of things we build. But then, of course, we know where the world is going through Web3 and so on. So we've also got more progressive, perhaps longer term view in terms of, okay, how will people consume sport in digital form and what levels of interaction or what forms of interaction will they require compared to what they might get in other walks of life, so to speak.
So what you're doing there is second guessing where the market for consumption of sport is going and trying to provide products, or I always see you as the pipes. I don't know, it always comes up, the plumbing bit, but there is you've got the data coming from one end, from the sports, and essentially what you're saying is that you're finding new ways to use that and monetize that.
Exactly, and it's about productizing the data, basically, right, yeah. Because you're right, the data is the raw material, if you like. So then we, as we've always done, really, we started off collecting data for sports books. We then turn those into odds products. We then turn those into live odds products. We then turn those into... So we lead and follow the market, I think. We can, because the market only do what we can facilitate. So we make investments early, such as we've done with Fan ID, such as we've done with a whole range of products and services. But, and the source most of the time will be data, and it's how do we build a product out of that data? And that's, generally speaking, our modus operandi.
Okay, so there's a load there. Let's just pick out a couple of things. And I'm linking this to sort of recent conversations that I've been having. Mm-hmm. We had, for example, we had Tia White from Amazon on AWS, and we were talking there about personalization, and this takes the data conversation into that marketing realm. And we talked about the much discussed end of the cookie and what that means. And it's a subject which, because I have been talking, I mean, I first came across this and we had someone on talking about 18 months ago where this was going to happen. And now we're told it's now imminent. This is going to happen. Can you just explain, before we get too complicated, about why this is important? Why do I care about this?
Well, it's pretty seismic. I think everyone certainly needs to care about it. And I think the world has kind of woken up to the significance and the importance of the change, because it will change materially the way the digital economy operates and works, which is, so it needs adjustment from all parts of it, for sure. But I mean, so there's lots of challenges, and of course the root of the change is a globally different view on what constitutes privacy, individual privacy, and GDPR have taken a new position on that, quite rightly, and lots of other jurisdictions are following suit. So we know that the world is going to change in and around how commercial entities should respect individual rights. And that's, as I say, we see that as a positive step. What was also happening as a consequence is that businesses in Amazon, certainly well aware of this, or AWS, is that it is, the response is a much more amenable view towards data sharing. So the idea of businesses that historically might have been semi-competitive starting for mutual benefit to share first-party data, which is where the world is heading, has increased significantly. And we see it already in certainly retailers and their constituent brands. You see it certainly with media owners and advertisers. So pooling first-party data, so good, precise, accurate, insightful data around individuals, pooling it on a privacy-compliant basis, and both sides, or all participants, let's say, benefiting. So those were the two sort of environmental shifts, if you like, that we observed, and we thought, okay, that's actually putting rights holders in a strong position, because most federations, leagues, teams, even players sit on, have been gathering first party data for quite a long time to a greater or lesser extent, but have been finding it very difficult to do anything with it to some extent, other than, I guess, inform their own sort of owned and operated activities. Yeah, and that's fine as far as it goes. But what they haven't really been able to do is to make it accessible to their sponsors and partners, for example, to reciprocally benefit from any insight that those sponsors and partners might have. And then, of course, kind of go to market with it and start to monetize it in new and interesting ways. So two shifts, one opportunity. And then we 2.5 years ago, basically sat down and said, OK, what's the platform that's going to enable all that? How can we build something that is privacy compliant in the new world, that acknowledges that third-party cookies, as far as we kind of know them, will disappear, that puts rights owners in, I guess, kind of primary position in respect of the ecosystem that we're building, but that also provides brands and sponsors with new and very interesting opportunities to personalise around the sports that they are investing significant amounts of money to associate with.
So let's just take me through things. So I'm a Spurs fan.
Yep.
How do I give my data away? Does the club know I'm a Spurs fan if I don't buy a season ticket, or I don't go to their website or whatever? But I'm indicating in some way my allegiance.
Well, I guess, yes, there's different levels of how we might infer that you're a Spurs fan. One is that, of course, like me, actually, although I'm a United fan, my son's a Spurs fan, so I do have a little membership. So I've been to Spurs platforms.
That's evolution right there. You see
exactly,
how that works?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I've bought a few things. So they probably think I'm a Spurs fan. I haven't told them I'm a United fan, but on certain days I am. But more materially, perhaps, I bought things. They know when I'm kind of buying tickets. So they can see I'm a very occasional fan, perhaps. Certainly much more casual than my son. But the important thing is they have an identity for me. They have an email address. They have a
an identifier, let's say, a mobile phone, whatever it may be. So once you have that, then of course you can then start to connect my identity with other signals I might emit through certain, my Vodafone contract, or I don't know the exact Spurs sponsors, I probably should, but you know, so if I've got a profile at a travel company or a telco or a beer brand or whatever it may be, of course they'll have insight on me that can, is based on identification as well. So the challenge and the opportunity though at the same time is just to connect all that, to build that lovely rich kind of profile around me or you as Spurs fans. So dimensionalize it not just on the basis of your, which play you love, but which airline you prefer, whatever it may be, or which car you might be in the market for. And that's where the data clean room comes into play, because what that, or what ours, not all of them do this, but what ours does is that it is what we call multi-party. So a pretty limitless number of participants can submit their first-party data and share it. And it's also built on confidential computing, so which makes it privacy safe. So no one is fearful of either any lack of compliance to privacy regulation and also any threat to their own data sovereignty. So each brand decides their own rules of engagement. They decide what data they want to submit. So what that allows you to do then is build these deep profiles around individuals, which is, of course, the basis for personalization. You can only personalize if you've got a granular understanding of what people want, prefer, and intend to do. That's when, of course, personalization starts to really come into its own.
And so the clean room, what is that? Just explain what that is. I'm trying to link that to the cookie question. So is that just means that there's you tell me, what is it?
Okay, well, the cookie deals with the kind of data you can collect, basically, or the way in which you can collect data. So I'm sorry, maybe it wasn't clear enough initially, but so we are moving from a world that's been largely fueled by third-party cookies, so cookies that sit on your bits of code, that sit on your browser and observe your behavior without really you knowing about it, and will do that across all of your browsing behavior. And that's really how the advertising, because of change in GDPR, Safari, Firefox said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore because we think that contravenes this new view on privacy. Google carried on but said, we will deprecate, we will end third-party cookies. And in fact, just last month, actually, we had it delayed for a couple of years because there wasn't really a suitable solution in place. They finally, in January, deprecated 1% of their browser traffic. So they've taken that first step in terms of doing what Safari and Firefox have done. So regardless of when it happens, everybody is resigned to the fact now that is not a tracking technology that we can rely on. So, of course, that then says, everyone sits down and says, what do we do now? So this is where the notion of first-party data, which are also cookies, and this is, I think, where people perhaps get a little confused. They're also bits of code, basically, but they are given consensually and only tracked on sites that you voluntarily visit. So you go to spurs.com, they will put a first-party cookie because they're entitled to, and you will click your consent as you manage cookies. So that's the big difference now. So if you as Spurs, and you as perhaps the Premier League as well, maybe, because they'll have some data probably on you in some ways, again, consensually given, first party. Then the Spurs brand partners, again, that they might have observed you in first party form at some point. So what the clean room does is allow you to connect all of that. But it does it, without getting too technical, it does it by anonymizing every identity, but then seeing the points of connection between that identity. So nobody knows, no one can, that's right, it does get common, no one can reverse engineer, is the expression they use, back to you, if you like. But everybody knows that connected data is a specific ID. And that's really what you want. So you want ID XYZ, we do need to know it's Richard. ID XYZ shows these attributes. And therefore, on that basis, this is where the other critical component of the platform comes in, is we can then go and find you in the wider internet domain. So not just on spurs.com, but we can go and find you on other places that you may choose to spend your time online. And we do that through a whole new technology called identity networks, which is another story. but one I'm happy to tell today if we've got time.
So in terms of my experience, I'm wondering what the upside to this is. Will I notice much of a difference? Because my grumble with these things is that when you go on and you then sort of click on the where my data has been sold to, and there's a whole load. I go on the Daily Mail, and then there's sort of hundreds of these sort of intermediaries where the publisher has sort of taken my identity and given it to a whole load of other people who then sell it on, and there's that sort of chain that's developed. Does this mean that's not going to exist anymore? I mean, it's that sort of the criticism of ad tech, isn't it? That it's just slowed everything down, it's made everything cumbersome, and you lose that sort of sense of trust that you might have with an established publisher, that actually I don't mind personalization if I'm doing it with you, Spurs, or whatever media outlet I'm trusting to do that. But what I don't like is that I'm just a commodity that is just being sold everywhere, and I'm getting load of shit coming back off.
It's absolutely designed to address that very question, because, and in fact, and certainly, I think pretty much anyone in the industry would now hold that view. Some businesses will be challenged, but it's certainly our philosophy that, and I think many others, that this is an opportunity now, as you say, to build a very positive value exchange between advertiser, rights holder, whomever it may be, and a fan. So you know that, okay, I'm very happy to submit this insight about me because I know I'm going to get a very positive experience in return. And I think that is certainly where we want to get to, and in some respects, where we need to get to, because you're right, people's trust, the integrity of the digital economy is, I think, has been under threat, hence GDPR taking a pretty tough position on it. And I think this is a chance to say, okay, right, there are new set of laws, we build technology that can now put in place a very positive, constructive cooperation between data owner and data giver, or no, that's probably the same person, but data giver and data receiver, let's say, to the point where it's good both sides, and there is that trust restored, which I think is a good way of putting it.
Well, I was going to say that maybe the sort of virtuous look at this is that sports rights holders are in a good position, that presumably they are more trusted than by people who are interested in them than just a random media outlet on the internet. So there is a sort of upside. I can see that if that's a story that resonates, or they can make resonate, I could see this being a commercial advantage. Because there's always been this question of, and it's been there for a long time, in terms of that shift to first-party data by football clubs. The football clubs don't know who we are, and there's that sort of breakdown in the promise of the internet or digital advertising, which is that you're supposed to one-to-one, but actually they don't really know. And this feels like this might be a shift, a tangible shift in the right direction. There's always a question here about, and again, this comes up a lot, is that our football clubs, if it's a club level or league, whatever the rights holder entity is, whether they are equipped to do much with this information when they get it. So you can clean up the stuff all you like, but ultimately it'll go to quite a small organisation at the other end, and they haven't got the marketing capability to take a full advantage of this. And I'm wondering, and again, it gets back to whether or not they're going to have to change in some fundamental way in terms of the people that they employ or the culture or whatever, or they're just going to have to buy this in. And
certainly, first point, absolutely agreed. Sport is kind of hallowed territory. The loyalty demonstrated in sport needs to be respected because it's probably deeper than any other walk of life. Your willingness not to suddenly, you just won't find that in any other product vertical, I wouldn't have thought, with maybe a couple of exceptions. So that absolutely needs to be respected. So I think it is that opportunity now to say, okay, value your fandom, and on that basis, everything you tell us about you, we want to respect and build experiences around. So I think that's the first question. The second question is, you're right, that what we try and encourage now, particularly rights holders, to think about is that their data set is as much a value asset as their stadium or their players or their TV rights or whatever, because it is. It is deep, scaled, insightful data can be monetized in lots of different ways, and therefore it's almost incumbent on them now to make sure that data is in good shape. So whether it is outsourcing to people like us, or whether it is getting
people internally who know the way around this question, and it's probably both, that is a crucial first step, is to say, okay, I recognize that data, first-party data, from even if I don't have any or I've got very little, I need to recognize that this is something I've got to find and collect. So that, but so even if they're very mature against this, immature in this question, you know, there are still things they can do. But I think that mental shift of seeing data as crucial to the commercial operation of the business, I think, is the first step. And of course, lots of rights owners are already there and way beyond. And then, of course, you're right. The whole reason we brought this platform to market is to enable pretty much any rights holder to start to do things with the data that they haven't up to now been able to. And that's either independently, so with their own set of commercial sponsors, perhaps, or own other parts of their own ecosystem, or in combination with their leagues or federations. So I think the configuration of how rights owners can get involved is flexible. So I think that should give opportunity for pretty much anyone to start to move in the right direction against this question.
How big a deal is this for Sportradar compared to their sort of the core business?
Well, I mean, strategically, it's very important because it's, of course, we've spent 23 years building a betting data business that is very significant, although we've now got a very significant audiovisual business, and we have a range of products and services that we've successfully built out from that betting data provenance. So in commercial terms, it's not significant as yet, but strategically it's very important because these are the new areas we have chosen to explore. When we IPO'd back in 2021, it was a big part of the story we told to the market then, was to say, look, okay, yes, we've got our very strong core that we're going to continue to build out, but we want to find new ways of deploying our data and technology capabilities. So, and FunID is certainly a good example of that, because it's, you're kind of combining a few different things. Not many businesses can operate data and technology at scale in the way that we can. Not many businesses have already built vertical specific marketing platforms such as we have 5 years ago, and not many businesses have the scale of relationships. In fact, it's probably rare to find that anybody's got the scale of relationships we have across the sports ecosystem. We do play that kind of semi-neutral systemic role within sports. So you put all that together and we're in a position to invest, as I say, ahead of the opportunity, if you like, to bring something to market that's ready to go right from day one.
So you hear sometimes people say, well, the big opportunity is sport, and the reframing of the commercial appeal of a sports rights holder is based in data. But it feels like they've sold that to you anyway. So I'm trying to work out if you're going to take that data and make a successful product and a clean room and a fan ID product, whatever. The horse has bolted, isn't it? From sports perspective, they've always, in the same way as they devolved the customer relationship to television for years, now they've done that with customer data to you and to a few others. In terms of, that's valuable, you've paid a lot of money for it to the rights holders, and now you're making a product out of it, which is fine. But I'm just, how do you see that evolving?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rich. I mean, the facts are, all of our data deals to date are around event data, so what happens when, and of course our abilities to collect deeper, more granular data in and around what is happening, if you like, is increasing all the time through investments we're making in computer vision, AI, and other things besides. So, and that has been our historical business. Now, this FunID question relates to fan data, as you say, which we're kind of approaching in a different way, in the sense that we don't want to go and buy or buy access rights to people's fan data. We want to provide the technology that enables to do much more interesting, progressive and valuable things with that data. So we will take a kind of neutral role around, we'll help them collect data, absolutely. We'll help them connect it, we'll help them activate it, and we'll orchestrate the whole thing. But we're not, in the same way we might with an official data partner, event data partner status, we're not seeking to take any governance over that data, if you like. So this is a platform proposition that we can put in the hands of anybody, and we have different ways of monetizing from our point of view, but it isn't, we wouldn't monetize fan data in the same way that we have historically, and not always, but historically, or the business model applies to event data.
So you're sort of selling their own fans back to them, is that right? I'm just trying to work out how that...
No, we are helping them certainly improve the experiences of their own fans, first of all, and also help them monetize their own fans, which all commercial entities need to do. And I think that's those are the two key driving forces in terms of what we're trying to build.
Let's talk about what you know. What does, on the betting side, on the sports book side, what do they know about sports fans that is useful? Is because it feels to me that's the bit of the jigsaw, that relationship, which is really sticky, and it's there's a lot of information that we give over just in that transaction. It feels like much more of a retailer, like a Dunnhumby type relationship,
yeah,
that you've got with a customer, rather than a sort of arm's length where there's a bit of second guessing and a bit of trickery. But the punter sports book relationship is incredibly rich with information. We give a load over, don't we, during those transactions?
We do. And again, it's a very good observation, because and you can extend that and say that, okay, maybe merchandise transactions or ticketing transactions, where money changes hands, if you like, always pretty good kind of indicator of intent. So those very high, what we would call high value data signals, are of course very important ones to consider. And in fact, we have an aspect to the FanID clean room that we're developing, which we call Bedrock Partners. And Bedrock Partners is designed to recognize exactly what you say, that, okay, you've got these recurring businesses in sport, so sportsbook operators, media owners, merchandise companies, ticketing businesses, who, of course, hold highly valuable insight into people's preference and intent. So in terms of the composition of the clean room, wouldn't it be great to have those data providers kind of already plugged in, if you like? And we're talking to various of our partners around this theory. And in so doing, it becomes almost, it's certainly an opportunity for those businesses to monetize their own data, if you like, but also then for a whole bunch of other businesses to benefit from the insight that these Bedrock partners bring. And I think that kind of triangulation, we think, is potentially very interesting, and something that, you know, in terms of the way we refer to the clean room as sports specific, you know, the same way we do with pretty much all the technology, we build it with the sports vertical in mind, nothing else, then certainly this Bedrock Partners idea and development is a significant part of that.
I remember we spoke at the London event, and we were talking about convergence at that point. And it was interesting, as the conversation went on, and there was people, questions on the floor, but also we were just discussing the idea of the sort of the future bundle. And we then start to say, well, what sort of winners can we expect here? And it feels like that the people you mentioned there, it might be a Fanatics in one bit of the industry, and Amazon is an obvious place to go. They're all looking at, in one lens, they're saying, right, this is an argument to buy sports rights, media rights. We can do this, and then we can make money back from not just selling subs and advertising, but there are other routes of doing it. What do you think about that question? Because again, you're in the middle of, I always think of Sport Radio in the middle of this conversation. How do you think that market's going to evolve, that convergence conversation? Because again, we talked a bit about, in the States, it's about DraftKings and FanDuel and breaking that duopoly and finding routes through. But more generally, what's your sense of how that's going to evolve, that just that marketplace?
I think it's going to evolve pretty quickly, as we kind of touched on really last year. And I think there's a couple of significant developments since we spoke then, which you'll know about, in ESPN and Fanatics both finally launching with their own platforms. ESPN investing a significant amount, certainly back end of last year, to launch it. And quite how that, certainly as far as the product conversion, let's say, or the practical convergence between the transaction betting and their content, where they take that, is going to be very interesting to observe, because certainly that's a one-way track. I mean, I think I've talked about our Embet product, which is integrated betting into streaming, as an example of, or further example of that convergence. And there's also an interesting development in La Liga, where they created a new asset class, if you like, called interactive rights, basically. So it was anything that happens over or alongside the broadcast stream has been set aside as a new asset class, basically. and there's a clearinghouse effectively attached to it. So anyone who is part and parcel of the experiential provision, interactive or transactional in and around the stream, shares in the available revenue. So the fact that rights holders have actually started to kind of recognise this and create new asset verticals or rights verticals accordingly, I think is an interesting step. So, and we'll see how that continues. So I think certainly convergence generally remains a very significant question for the media and betting industries for sure.
The La Liga thing is interesting. What I never quite know what the difference between a betting right is and a data right, or whatever, in terms of what you're buying and what you can do with it from the rights holder perspective. Because there's a slight difference in the way, say, the Premier League deals with this issue compared to Bundesliga.
Yes. So you're right. There's no common way of, or configuration, I guess, of A, how you carve up your different sets of rights and what relationship you want with third parties in terms of how you would monetize them. So all the way from official betting partner status, as certainly with the MLB, the NHL, the NBA, a status we hold, similar with ATP and some other significant rights holders to whom we are exclusive in our relationship. And we have official rights over data, and we are entitled to build products and services on the back of those, all the way to a much less organized environment where official data status doesn't exist.
You mentioned ESPN, it's just on my mind. You'll have seen this, the ESPN Fox, Warner Brothers Discovery streaming product that's going to come to market in the summer. And I was then trying to work out what do you think about that? Just give me your view of how that's going to work. Because a lot of the conversations we're having here get mashed together when something like that happens. That there's quite a lot of shared rights and things that duplicate, and things within that bundle, but within those three big media houses, I've no idea how they then work out what happened.
Indeed, I think everyone's still trying to decipher what it all means for sure. I think the root of it is scale. You know, ultimately, this is now particularly around the major sports, this is a scaled game. So I think anything that can consolidate, bring scale, such as this deal should, I think is kind of necessary, certainly if rights holders want to, you know, monetize in the broadcast environment in the way that they have been. And, of course, the shift now from, you know, linear to streaming or CTV is accompanying that. So let's see how that plays out. But I think those are the driving forces, would be my estimation.
We'll head to the end. The ambition of SportsRadar, I'm interested in. You've got these various options. I'm always interested in what you decide not to do as much as what you decide to do, because you've got this funnel of data that you've got coming from one side. You've got the partners on the various marketplaces that you've got for that product. And I think it's quite instructive for everyone else to see, okay, that's the bet they've taken in terms of that's where they're heading, or one of the routes. What bits do you think you've gone cold on? What do you think over the last sort of 5 years, maybe whatever the period, when you're looking at these types of decisions, there's a whole load that you think, actually, no, we thought that was going to work, that's sort of, we've cooled on that. Where would you say that's
applicable? Yeah, I mean, the good news is there haven't been too many instances, and certainly no significant instances of what you might call misreading an opportunity, if you like. Those where we have expanded outside our core, we always do it in a pretty measured way. We always do our diligence. We invest in technology earlier, so we bring a product to market that's kind of ready to go. And so that has helped us, I think. That said, though, I mean, I think there is a danger when you have such a, enviable position within the sports ecosystem, you're right, to try and build products for everybody. And that's certainly not what we're seeking to do. We're very clear. And in fact, you'll have seen in the news a couple of weeks ago, we've just been through an operational streamlining, if you like. And I think that's a reflection of our very clear focus on the markets. Two things really. One is, I think, how we build our products, if you like, or how we access the raw material for our products, I think is a key question in our mind, and one that we are very focused on. So investments in computer vision, new ways of collecting data at scale that is going to revolutionise the products we can build, certainly, and some of that sort of already started. And I think so we're very focused absolutely on that, and I think the fan data question is to some extent related to the same issue. And then beyond that, with that potential to serve everybody, we have, in the last couple of years since the IPO, been very focused in terms of, okay, what are the new markets and opportunities that we want to serve, and fan engagement and the different layers of that value chain, as we see it, have really been the framework through which we've, or the lens through which we've kind of applied ourselves. So very disciplined against those things that where we can bring scale and that we can bring significant value to all of our customer groups. And those are always, well, A, it's the way we approach things, and B, those are always the two key factors in our mind. So, and once we have that framework, then unless something materially significant changes environmentally, then we're pretty focused on that. So that will be the frame of reference for sure for a period of time.
And at the TV end, so when I'm watching the telly, sport on telly, and I'm looking at sort of innovations, because sometimes sports television gets, well, it's not changed for decades, but it's still basically the same. And then when I look at other stuff, and it tends to come from the betting arena where you've got overlays and you've got all mm-hmm. of this sort of innovation that's taking place. I quite often wonder what drives what in terms of whether or not it's the, on the betting side, is driving that innovation, try and get their product closer, which is a version of convergence where you're seeing these two worlds sort of collide. And then it's almost like a what's acceptable to the mainstream, like an Overton window argument where you've got mm-hmm. like this, it shifts over time.
Yep.
And people sort of say, yeah, okay, well, I'm now used to it. I now expect to have all of this data at hand and I can then bring that up on my telly. I'm just wondering where the source of that is, because it's quite often not the rights holder. The rights holder is quite often a beneficiary of this. The product's been taken and made better by the media side.
Yes, although it tends, certainly what we, the reason or the benefits of having such close relationships with the rights holders, certainly the major leagues, is that when you develop things, you're doing it in partnership. So you're very clear that the rights holder are happy with any innovation that might be, even in a broadcast capacity, put in front of their fans. And I think that's crucial. Any league should govern that, or at least have a say in that. So, because of course, and the other aspect to it is that in and around how you provide these new experiences, a lot of it is based on the raw data. These days, I go back to the skeletal data we're now collecting in certain sports. This is 25,000 data points that, as soon as you've got that in real time, you can really start to do some interesting things. But without the ability to collect that and to be given that exclusive opportunity, such as we are with our rights owners, you can't get anywhere near a product like that. So I think, and of course you'd much prefer to do it, or the application of that data and how you build products, I think you'd much prefer for that to be done absolutely hand in hand with the rights owner themselves. Of course, broadcasters will have a view and have a seat at the table in terms of what is brought to market. But remember now, of course, lots of rights holders have got their own D2C offerings where they can put innovative broadcast type products in market without the reliance necessarily of a media owner. So it is it's a more nuanced debate and conversation. Our view has always been, and our desire has always been, to work very closely with rights owners and to concentrate really on getting access to the, as I say, the raw data that then facilitates all these new interesting broadcast products.
We've got like it seems to me that there's a bit of this, which is, if I am track and field, there's a whole load of bundle of things in the Olympics, sports that I never think or care about for 4 years until they come back on the Olympics. And if my job is, if I'm the CEO of one of those sports, javelin, for example, stuff out there that could find an audience, I could go and play in this sort of area on the broadcast side and just make my sport more entertaining. I could push it more towards a sort of entertainment level using what's out there already. And there's a sort of innate conservatism in some sports, but they're all facing this, quite often talk about this sort of existential stuff about Gen Z and, you mm-hmm. know, media rights market blowing up and all of those things. And they're on this constant trying to work out how to evolve their sports. And I always find it quite interesting how conservative quite often sports remain, given that when you look across at the coverage of some sports, they've gone full into the entertainment bit of it. Mm-hmm. By entertainment, I suppose I'm including betting on that, but I'm interested in not in betting specifically, but in the impact of what happens when a sport goes down that route, because it does change the way in which it appears to the viewer.
For sure. I mean, having spent a night at the PDC, Ali Pali, before Christmas, you can see the potential success of packaging the sport in the right way, using a few cues from the US, perhaps not ignoring a few of the diversity questions. Lots of sports are being asked, but, you know, no doubt about it, they've produced a product there that is highly successful. And of course, when you throw in a 16-year-old into the mix from who comes from nowhere, that's always going to help. But I think a great job in terms of embracing, well, taking risks with sport, because you're right, there's always going to be a hardcore who are reactionary and don't necessarily embrace these new things. And any sport, governor of sport, has to balance those two things. And you look at what's happening in cricket, the challenges there, for example, in the UK. But I think even minor changes to baseball this year on the shot clock, for example, in the US, haven't been simple things to impose, because, of course, there are traditionalists who are against it. So you are, the bigger your sport, the bigger diversity of opinion you're going to have to try and canvas and deal with. And those sports that take risks and favour the future, I think, are those to be reckoned with.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, listen, Mike, thanks a lot, as ever. Thanks a lot for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation. And we will, at some point, reconvene.